Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the best podcast ever, talking about The Red and the Black, book 2, chapter 21, BYO discussion prompt again. Another complete shift in the story, says Laura Weistich. Things are getting interesting again. Given what the last few chapters have been like, says non-creative handle, this was not what I had envisioned, from a chapter called The Secret Note. Shmoop.com had this to say. The Marquise de La Mole summons Julian and tests his famous memory to see whether he can memorize an entire page of a newspaper instantly. He wants Julian to come with him to a secret political meeting and to memorize everything he hears so that he can deliver the message to a duke from a foreign country. The Marquise is worried that spies will try to stop Julian along the way and read anything that's written down. That's why Julian needs to have the thing in his memory. The Marquise tells him to buy himself some new clothes in order to disguise his identity. The Marquise takes Julian to a secret meeting, ensuring that Julian is not aware of where they are in Paris. One by one, a bunch of very important people, including bishops and even the Prime Minister, enter the room. A bit of intrigue, hey? A bit of espionage all of a sudden. He's an international spy. That's all the discussion we had, but rest assured, we're about to read chapter 2, which is called The Discussion. So here's some more discussion for you. It starts with this. The Republic, for each man nowadays who would sacrifice everything to the public good, there are some thousands and millions thinking of nothing but their own enjoyments, their vanity. In Paris, a man is valued not for his virtue, but on account of his carriage. Napoleon Memorial. The footman rushed in, calling out, Monsieur le Duc de Dash. Be quiet, you are nothing but a fool, said the Duke as he entered. He said this so adeptly and with such majesty that Julian could not help but think that the art of being angry with a lackey must be this great man's whole attainment in life. Julian raised his eyes and immediately lowered them again. He had divined the importance of this new arrival so accurately that he trembled in case his glance had been indiscreet. The Duke was a man of 50, dressed like a dandy, and advancing with a springing step. He had a narrow head with a larger nose and a curved face held forward. It would have been difficult to appear at once so noble and so insignificant. His arrival was the signal for the meeting to begin. Julian's physiognomical observations were abruptly interrupted by the voice of Monsieur de La Mole. May I present to you Monsieur l'Abbé Sorel, said the Marquise. He has the gift of an astounding memory. It was only an hour since that I informed him of the mission of which he has been honoured, yet to furnish proof of his powers he has learned the first page of La Quotidienne off by heart. Ah, the news from abroad about poor N Dash, said the master of the house. He hurriedly took up the newspaper and, gazing at Julian with an air that was comical in its effort to seem imposing, said to him, Speak on, monsieur. There was profound silence. All eyes were fixed on Julian. He recited so proficiently that at the end of 20 lines the Duke interrupted, That's enough. The little man, with the wild boar eyes, sat down. He was evidently the president, for hardly was he seated than he indicated a little card table to Julian and signed for him to bring it up next to him. Julian settled himself there with the necessary writing materials. He counted 12 men around the green cloth. Now, Monsieur Sorel, retire into the next room, said the Duke, and we'll send for you. The master of the house took on a very worried air. The shutters weren't closed enough, he told his neighbour in a low tone, and it's no use looking out of the window, he foolishly called out after Julian. Well, here I am more or less thrust into a conspiracy, thought the latter. Luckily, it's not the kind of thing that leads to the place de Grieve. Even if there was some danger, I owe the acceptance of it and more to the Marquise. I'll be delighted if I am given the chance to atone for all the suffering my foolish actions may one day cause him. While continuing to dwell on his follies and his unhappiness, he studied the place so as never to forget it. Only then did he recall that he had not heard the Marquise tell the footman the name of the street, and that the Marquise had ordered a cab, something he never normally did. Julian was left alone with his thoughts for a long time. He was in a salon hung with red velour, with ample gold stripes. On the table there stood a great ivory crucifix, and on the chimney-piece was Monsieur de Maistre's de Papy, with gilt edges and a magnificent binding. So as not to seem to be listening, Julian turned its pages. From time to time, voices were raised in the next room. At last the door opened, and he was called in. Remember, messieurs, said the president, that from this moment we're talking in front of Duke Lee Dash. This gentleman here, he went on, gesturing towards Julian, is a young Levite devoted to our holy cause, who with the whole help of his astounding memory can easily repeat everything we have to say down to the last detail. It is now that the gentleman's turn to speak, he said, indicating the personage with the fatherly look, and who was wearing three or four waistcoats. Julian thought it might have been more natural to call the gentleman with the waistcoats by name. He took some paper and wrote extensively. Here the author had wished to put in a page full of dots. That would show very little grace, said the editor, and if so frivolous a piece of writing lacks grace, it is fatal. Politics, retorts the author, is a milestone tied to the neck of literature and drowns it in less than 6 months. Politics is imaginative work, is like a shot in the middle of a concert. The noise is deafening, but it imparts no energy. It doesn't harmonize with the sound of any other instrument. Such political talk mortally offends half of one's readers and bores the other half, who in a different context in the morning paper find such things interesting and lively. If your characters don't talk politics, replies the editor, this is no longer France in 1830, and your book is not the mirror you pretend it to be. Julian's record of what was said ran to 26 pages. What follows is a very colourless version, for as usual it is necessary to suppress the ridiculous bits, the excesses of which would seem odious and barely credible, witness the Legal Gazette. The gentleman in the waistcoats, with the paternal air, perhaps he was a bishop, smiled frequently, and as he did so, the orbs beneath his fluttering lids took on a strange brilliance and a less wavering gaze than usual. This personage, invited to speak first before the Duke, but what Duke, wondered Julian, and seemingly in order to expound the state of opinion and to play the part of the general advocate, seemed to Julian to fall into the uncertainties and failures and to reach the firm conclusions with which such magistrates are often taxed. As the discussion went on, the Duke himself went so far as to criticise him for this. After delivering several sentiments of a moral and pleasing nature, the man in the waistcoats said, Noble England, under the guidance of great man the immortal Pitt, spent 40,000 million francs counteracting the revolution. If the meeting will allow me to touch with some frankness on a melancholy subject, England didn't sufficiently understand that with a man like Bonaparte above all, when there is nothing to oppose him with but a host of good intentions, nothing could be decisive but personal methods. Oh, another speech in praise of assassination, said the master of the house with a worried look. Spare us your sentimental remarks, cried the president testily, with his wild boar eye glittered ferociously. Go on, he said to the man with the waistcoats. His cheeks and forehead were reddening. Noble England, continued the speaker, is now exhausted, for every Englishman before he can buy his daily bread is forced to pay with the interest of the 40,000 million francs used against Jacobins. England no longer has a Pitt. She does have the Duke of Wellington, said a military personage, assuming a very important air. Gentlemen, silence, if you please, cried the president. If we go on with these disputes, it will have been pointless to have introduced Monsieur Sorel. We're aware that Monsieur abounds with ideas, said the Duke irritably, glaring at the interrupter, who had been a general under Napoleon. Julian understood that this remark contained some highly offensive personal allusion. Everyone smiled. The renegade general seemed incensed. There is no longer a pit, messieurs, continued the speaker, putting on a discouraged air of a man who despairs of making his hearers see reason. Even were there a new pit in England, you cannot fool the people in the same way twice. That's why a conquering general, a Bonaparte, is an impossibility for France in future, cried the interrupting soldier. On this occasion, neither the president nor the Duke ventured a protest, though Julian thought he could see in their eyes how very much they were tempted. They lowered their gaze, and the Duke contented himself with sighing so that all could hear, but the speaker had been riled. People are eager to see me finish, said he heatedly, suddenly abandoning the smiling politeness and measured tones that Julian judged to be the true expression of his character. People are eager to see me finish. They take no account at all of the efforts I am making not to offend the ears of a single person, however long those might be. Well then, monsieur, I shall be brief. So I assure you, in the crudest terms, England hasn't a penny left in the service of the good cause. Supposing a Pitt were to return, even all his genius would not succeed in fooling the small freeholders of England. For they, know that the brief campaign of Waterloo alone cost them 1,000 million francs. Since you require plain talk, the speaker added, working himself up more and more, I assure you, you must be help yourselves, for England hasn't a guinea to spare you, and when England doesn't pay, Austria, Russia, and Prussia, who have only courage and no money, will be capable of waging no more than one, perhaps two, campaigns against France. One might hope that the young soldiers the Jacobins could raise would be beaten in the first campaign, and maybe in the second, but in the third, yes, let me appear revolutionary to your prejudiced eyes. In the third you will encounter the warriors of 1794, not the enlisted peasants of 1792. Here interruptions were heard from three or four sides at once. Monsieur, the president said to Julien, go into the next room and make a fair copy of the first part of the minute you have written. Julien went out, much regretting having to do so. The speaker was just about to consider probabilities he had often thought about himself. They are afraid I might laugh at them, he reflected. When he was called back again, Monsieur de La Mole was speaking with an earnestness that seemed to Julien, who knew him, extremely amusing. Yes, messieurs, it is this unhappy people above all that one may ask, will this be a god, a table, or a basin? It will be a god, cried the fabulist, and it is to you, messieurs, that this saying, so noble and so profound, applies especially. Act for yourselves, and then that noble France, almost like the one our ancestors created and which we ourselves saw before the death of Louis XVI, may reappear. England, her noble lords at least loathing noble Jacobins just as much as we do. Without English gold, Austria, Russia, and Prussia can manage only two or three battles. Will that be enough to lead to the benign occupation like the one that Monsieur de Richelieu dissipated at so foolishly in 1817? I don't think so. At this point, there would have been an interruption, but this was stifled by a universal shush. It had again originated from the former general of the emperor, who was yearning for a blue riband and had wanted to establish his position among the contributors to the secret note. I don't think so, repeated Monsieur de La Mole after the disturbance. He enunciated the I with an insolent hauteur that charmed Julien. Well played, he said to himself, while making his pen fly along almost as fast as the Marquis's words. With one well-placed phrase, Monsieur de La Mole was annihilated, has annihilated that turncoat's 20 campaigns. It is not to foreigners alone, continued the Marquise in very deliberate tones, that we should owe a new military occupation. All those young men who write inflammatory articles in the Globe might well produce 3,000 or 4,000 young captains, from among whom could emerge a Kleber, a Hoche, a Jourdan, a Pichegru, though less well-intentioned. We hadn't the sense to honour that fellow sufficiently, said the president. We should have made him immortal. In the end, there must be two parties in France, resumed Monsieur de La Mole. Not just two parties in name, but two parties very precisely divided, sharply demarcated. Let us be aware of what we must crush. On one side there stand the journalists, the electors, public opinion, in a word, youth and all that it admires. While that drowns itself in the din of its own empty words, we have the certain advantage of being sustained by the budget. Here there was another interruption. You then, Monsieur, replied Monsieur de La Mole to the interrupter with an admirably lofty ease. Since the word shocks you, you are not sustained. Rather, you devour the 40,000 francs from the state budget and the 80,000 you get from the civil list. And very well then, Monsieur, since you force me to it, I will be so bold as to take you for an example. Like your noble ancestors who followed St. Louis on crusade, you should be able to show us, on account of these 120,000 francs, a regiment or a company, half a company, even if there were only 50 men devoted, though life and death, to the good cause and prepare to fight. As it is, you have just a handful of lackeys who, if there were an uprising, would frighten no one but yourself. The throne, the altar, the nobility could perish tomorrow, messieurs, so long as you haven't created a force of 500 dedicated men in each department, and I mean dedicated, not just with all the gallantry of the French, but with a Spanish constancy too. Half this body should be made up of our sons, our nephews, of true gentlemen in short, and each of these should have at his side not a loquacious little bourgeoisie ready to hoist the tricolour cockade of if 1815 came around again, but a good peasant, simple and straightforward like Catalino, his own gentleman, would have instructed him in the cause. Ideally, they would have been suckled together as foster brothers. Let each of us sacrifice a fifth of his income to the raising of this dedicated band of 500 men per department. That's when you will be able to count on a foreign occupation. No foreign soldier is going to come in even as far as Dijon if he can't count on finding 500 friendly soldiers in each department. Foreign kings will listen to you only when you can tell them of 20,000 gentlemen ready to take up arms and open the gates of France. This task is very painful, you say. Messieurs, our own heads are the reward. Between the liberty of the press and our class's very existence, there is a war to the death. Change yourselves into manufacturers, peasants, or take up the gun. Be timid if you wish, but don't be stupid. Open your eyes. In the words of Jacobin song, I adjure you. Form your battalions. Then some noble Gustavus Adolphus may appear, who, stirred by the imminent threat to the monarchical principle, will swoop down from his own realm 1,000 miles away and do for you what he did for the Protestant princess. Do you choose to go on talking and doing nothing? Within 15 years there will be nothing but presidents and republics throughout Europe, not a single king, and with these four letters, K-I-N-G, will vanish both priests and the higher classes. I see nothing but candidates wooing unwashed majorities. It's all very well saying that just now in France there isn't a qualified general known and admired by all, that the army is organized solely in the interests of the throne and the altar, or that it is stripped of all its veterans, while every Prussian and Austrian regiment numbers 50 NCOs who have been under fire. There are 200,000 young townsmen out there who are in love with war. Enough of such unpleasant truths, interrupted a solemn personage in imposing tones, apparently a man of high ecclesiastical rank, for Monsieur de La Mole smiled pleasantly instead of being annoyed, a sure indication to Julian. Enough of such unpleasant truths, messieurs, we may sum up. A man who must have a gangrened leg cut off is in a poor position to tell his surgeon that the leg is perfectly healthy. If you will allow the expression, messieurs, the noble Duke de Dash is the surgeon we need. There at last the vital name has been pronounced, thought Julian. So it's towards the Dash that I'll be galloping tonight. All right, there we go. Another chapter done. Have your say about that chapter over at the subreddit. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.